And welcome back. It's Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
Blackbeard. Edward Teach, the pirate all pirates fear. Resurrector of the dead in his spare time. He listens to no one.
That's none other than Johnny Depp, a.k.a. Jack Sparrow, in the movie Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides, talking up the legend of the brutal pirate Edward Teach, better known as Blackbeard.
But along the Atlantic coast in the 1720s, there was a pirate even more well-known and perhaps more feared than Blackbeard. His name was Edward Lowe. And before raising the black and white skull and crossbones flag and becoming a pirate, Lowe operated as a Boston-based seaman.
So we're about to tell you the story of a dreaded New England pirate, one of his captives from Marblehead who escaped, and a years-long adventure marooned on a lonely island in the sea. It's the true story, a real-life American Robinson Crusoe, and it's told by author Greg Fleming in his new book, At the Point of a Cutlass, The Pirate Capture, Bold Escape, and Lonely Exile of Philip Ashton. Greg joins us now in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. So Philip Ashton is the man who gets captured by dread pirate Edward Lowe. And we're going to talk about him in a second. But I've got to spend a minute or two finding out from you a little bit more about why Edward Lowe was such a dreaded pirate in the 1720s. Tell us about him.
Oh, he was just horrific. We heard the clip about Blackbeard. And Blackbeard, of course, most people have heard about Blackbeard from the movies and so forth. But Edward Lowe was at the time, and this is a quote from one British official, said, "A greater monster never infested the seas." He captured more ships, he captured more men, and he was known for just horrific forms of torture against the sea captains that he took.
I mean, like almost unimaginable violence. I'm reading that he was known to roast the hearts of his victims over open fires and even at times forced his victims to consume their own charred ears?
He did. He did. It was awful. And some of that happened right here off the coast of New England.
Wow. Okay, so he is one of the worst pirates of the 18th century. And he captures a young man named Philip Ashton. Now, tell us who Philip Ashton was and why he was on the high seas to begin with.
So Philip Ashton was a cod fisherman from Marblehead, Massachusetts. At the time, in 1722, of course, Massachusetts, and particularly Marblehead, was the cod fishing capital of the world. Salt cod was a huge export out of New England. And they would go up to the coast of Nova Scotia for weeks at a time and catch cod and salt it. And it was, so he was up there going into a harbor to rest for the weekend when he encountered the pirate.
Was it common for pirates to target cod fishermen, or did the cod fishermen have no reason to worry?
No, they had every reason to worry. In fact, one of the real surprises in my research for this book was how commonplace it was for young men, both working on merchant vessels and on fishing vessels, to be captured by pirates and taken aboard.
Interesting, because Nova Scotia, the waters of Nova Scotia, aren't what you normally think of as pirate-infested waters. I mean, it's maybe because of the movies and current right. history, you think of it more the sort of warmer climes of the Atlantic. But in your book, At the Point of a Cutlass, you have an excerpt where you basically describe the moment where Philip Ashton's ship is boarded and he's face-to-face with pirates. And I was wondering if you could just read us that excerpt.
Yeah, sure, I'd be happy to. So as I mentioned, they went into Shelburne Harbor, which at the time was called Port Roseway, off the coast of Nova Scotia, on a Friday afternoon in June. Near sunset, after the men had been resting in the harbor at Port Roseway for 2 or 3 hours, Ashton looked up when he heard the knocking of oars against the wooden hull of a boat moving through the water. 4 men from a larger merchant vessel that was also anchored in the harbor were rowing in the direction of Ashton's schooner. The men pulled up to the side of the schooner and climbed aboard, and for a few final moments Ashton still thought nothing was wrong. Some of the crew from the brigantine, he assumed, men who had been away from their homes in Boston for more than 6 months, had come over to visit, trade stories, and catch up on local news. Even as the men climbed aboard, there was no cause for alarm. The men jumped in upon our deck without our suspecting anything, but that they were friends come on board to visit, or inquire what news, Ashton later recalled. But something wasn't quite right. Suddenly, the men were moving too quickly, too forcefully, and then panic struck.
That's author Greg Fleming reading from At the Point of a Cutlass, The Pirate Capture, Bold Escape, and Lonely Exile of Philip Ashton. Greg, in that excerpt, poor Philip sounds almost hopelessly naive or optimistic until basically he realizes that it's too late and the pirates have boarded his ship. So what happened right after that?
So after that, he and another fisherman from Ashton's vessel, Joseph Libby, were taken over to the pirate ship and forced at gunpoint to join the crew. Now, Ashton refused to sign on to the ship's articles, but he was impressed aboard nonetheless and sailed with this pirate, Edward Lowe, and his crew for 9 months across the Atlantic and back.
And what were those 9 months like? I mean, we described the brutality of Lowe for some of his captives or prisoners, but what about for the men that he impressed into service on his pirate vessel?
Yeah, so being a captive was no treat. I mean, Ashton was beat every couple of weeks. He was beat for refusing to join. He had to do all kinds of menial work. Captives were used regularly aboard pirate ships to cook, to clean, to stand watches, to climb up these tall, tall masts and help sail and manage the ship. So it was hard, and for Ashton it was particularly hard because Lowe never took a liking to him and never let him go ashore whenever they stopped, and it was a pretty brutal type of life.
And yet, if I understand correctly, there was some sort of code. I don't want to call it a democratic code, but, you know, some sort of code amongst the pirates and their crew while on board the ship.
Yeah. So pirate ships were remarkably democratic for the early 18th century, and they did have a set of articles that pirates could sign and agree to the terms of the ship, and that, you know, had rules about dividing up treasure when it was captured and other sorts of things. And so a pirate ship was positioned to the men who were recruited as a better life than serving on a merchant vessel. But the challenge for Ashton was he never joined the ship's articles or never signed the ship's articles. And so his life was one of more a servant and a captive.
Right. But as we said, this lasts for 9 months. Mm-hmm. And at the end of that time, Philip Ashton sees a chance for escape and takes it. So
yeah.
How does he do that?
So that was just an incredible moment. And it probably saved his life, although it almost killed him as well. They stopped in the far western part of the Caribbean in an island called Roatan, which is in Honduras now, and they stopped for water and to repair their ships, and Ashton pleads with some of the pirates to be taken ashore to help get water, drinking water. And they go ashore, and Ashton pretends to help, rolls the casks up onto the shore, then walks along the beach pretending he's looking for coconuts, and then dashes into the woods, and it's a very thick, wooded, jungle-like environment, and he hides out there and completely alone, waits for the pirates to leave, and he's marooned there all by himself with absolutely nothing.
For years.
For
right?
years. He lived there. He lived on the islands for close to 2 years, and most of that time was by himself.
Wow. And unlike the fictional Robinson Crusoe, who during his time on the island becomes a skilled craftsman, is able to construct many things and lives a life of, I don't know, relative pleasure. I mean, Philip Ashton, in his journals that he later wrote, basically says that for ages he just lived on fruit and couldn't even hunt because he had nothing.
Right. I mean, he could not have been any less prepared for what he faced. He had no knife, no gun, no way to make a fire. He didn't even have shoes. So he's walking in this rough tropical environment barefooted. And so initially, he's forced to just pick raw fruit from the trees, and he even digs up sea turtle legs out of the sand and eats those raw. Over time, he does get, you know, a way to make a fire, get some more tools, and then eventually he's rescued by some logwood cutters, and he lives a little bit better. But those first 9 to 10 months were just, you know, next to impossible.
Wow. I mean, it's, I was going to say it's cinematic, except this really happened in the 18th century. And he finally makes it back home to Marblehead. And his return is basically seen as a divine act.
It was. He came back to Marblehead. And the very Sunday after he got home, his minister, John Barnard, up in Marblehead, you know, brought him and his parents to church and gave a sermon about Ashton. And basically, the message was, look at, you know, God does protect those who are faithful. Look at what, you know, God did to Philip Ashton. And then Barnard later recorded Ashton's narrative, which is just this amazing buried treasure of a journal about what happened to him Which is quite interesting because Barnard didn't record it for the sake of history, but to, as you said, you know, communicate this religious message.
Right. And do we know if Daniel Defoe, author of Robinson Crusoe, if he ever had heard of Philip Ashton or read this narrative?
Yeah, there's speculation that, in fact, a year after Ashton's memorial was published here in Boston, it was also published in London. And there's speculation by scholars that Daniel Defoe did read it and used it in his next novel.
Okay. So I'm interested because this narrative from Philip Ashton about his years-long trial of being captured by pirates, escaping, being marooned on an island and returning home, not only is it a wonderful tale, but it's a historical document as well. I mean, I wonder does it give us any insights into the nature of piracy, who those men were, their effect on commerce in the 18th century and the waters off the Atlantic?
It does. I mean, one of the really striking things about this is the important role of captives. I mean, when we think of a pirate ship, we think of pirates with, you know, baggy clothes and, you know, a peg leg and bandanas on their heads. But the fact is that pirate ships during this era weren't just made up of pirates. They were made up of captives like Philip Ashton. It wasn't just Philip Ashton. There were many, many other captives who were taken during this period. And Ashton's provides, and there are other journals that I talk about and use in the book, but Ashton's provides probably the most comprehensive description of what it was like for a forced man aboard a pirate ship.
It does not sound pleasant at all. That's my understatement for the day. Whatever happened to Edward Lowe? I mean, if he was such an infamous pirate of the time, but yet he doesn't achieve sort of lasting historical fame like Blackbeard does.
I think that's because he just fades into the distance. He was never captured. He was never, as far as we know, he may have been killed, but he was never killed by the British, the Royal Navy.
Though they tried, they chased him quite a bit.
Many times. And half of his crew was actually captured off of Newport, Rhode Island, and hanged there in 1723. But Lowe and his most famous quartermaster, Francis Spriggs, got away, and as late as 1726, there were sightings of him down in the Bay of Honduras, off of Honduras. But nobody really knows whatever happened to Lowe.
You know, there's a wrinkle in his story that we have about 30 seconds to go here that I'd like you to help us understand. Because in the introduction to our conversation, we mentioned that dread pirate Edward Lowe began his career as a Boston seaman. Mm-hmm. So what made him turn to piracy?
We don't know for sure, but working as a sailor or a seaman from any port during this era was a really hard life. And a lot of men turned to piracy just because it was a freer, looser, more relaxed lifestyle. We also know just from Lowe's behavior, that, as we've been talking about, that he was just an awful man. I mean, he was probably bound for a life of crime anyway.
Wow. And yet history doesn't necessarily remember him as it might remember others until now with this new book. So Greg Fleming, author of the new book, At the Point of a Cutlass, The Pirate Capture, Bold Escape, and Lonely Exile of Philip Ashton. Such a pleasure to speak with you. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.